It was a violent day of protests in Seattle and Portland as rioters armed with bats and fireworks fought with police and federal agents. And Chris has the recap.
Yeah, things started out great in Seattle, actually. A peaceful gathering at Westlake Park, primarily a protest over federal immigration enforcement. But a few hours later, another organized group joined the party.
A peaceful demonstration was held for a couple of hours. About 3 hours later, a secondary group of demonstrators showed up. And they were carrying baseball bats.
Seattle Police Sergeant Lauren Truscott says that second group had only one mission, mayhem.
They graffitied the headquarters building, and then they graffitied the municipal court building, broke all of the lower windows out there.
But it wasn't just police or city buildings being targeted.
Individuals in the group appeared to target Starbucks and Amazon, both as they were heading towards headquarters and heading back northbound.
And that's when things started getting dicey. The group made a run at the West Precinct, throwing rocks and bottles and mortar-style fireworks at the officers.
The protesters then lit mortar-type fireworks and then threw them at officers from a very close range. The devices that they threw can blind, maim, and kill people when thrown from these short of distances.
Several officers suffered serious burns. When the attempt to take West Precinct failed, they went up to Capitol Hill and attacked the East Precinct, firing fireworks into the building. A small fire was started.
The result is at least 12 officers during this confrontation were injured. At least one officer is being treated at the hospital after fragmentation entered his neck and throat area. The other officers are being assessed and treated at the precinct.
Two people were arrested in Seattle yesterday, one for assault and another for theft. Down I-5 in Portland, it was another day of clashes between protesters and federal agents. About 1,000 protesters spent the day at the federal courthouse making attempts to breach the fence outside. Some in the crowd were armed with baseball bats, hockey sticks, helmets, and shields. They set fires and were eventually dispersed by federal agents. In a video that's now gone viral, you can see federal agents whacking a man who's just standing there with a baton and then hitting him with pepper spray. That man, 53-year-old Chris David, a Navy veteran, he just wanted to ask them a question.
I stood in the street in front of them, and I started asking them if they thought it was okay to violate their oath of the Constitution.
The baton strikes didn't seem to impact David, but he will likely need surgery.
They kept hitting me with batons, and I think they decided that wasn't going to work, so they just two pepper spray hits, I think I took. And that ended that. That was not fun. So I flipped him off, and then I walked to the corner of the park.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler telling CNN over the weekend the federal agents who are making the arrests are not helping this situation.
Their presence here is actually leading to more violence and more vandalism, and it's not helping the situation at all. They're not wanted here. We haven't asked them here. In fact, we want them to leave.
The Portland police put out a press release early this morning, a couple hours ago, highlighting the fact that it did not engage the protesters at all on Sunday. The Bureau wanted to make sure that everybody knew that this was a clash with federal agents, not its officers.
So is there anybody to know who's right here, whether the feds are making things better or worse?
I don't think so. I think it depends on who you ask. The feds are there protecting the courthouse. There was certainly some question about some of their tactics late last week as they were arresting people, taking them away in unmarked vans and kind of holding them for a little while and then letting them go. So it's not just, some people are saying this is a test case by the feds to see if it can work in Portland. It might work in other places. But the situation in Portland is different than what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. And the group that that again inserted itself into the peaceful protest here in Seattle, were there arrests made?
Yeah, it's two arrests, one for assault on the officer there at the West Precinct, another for theft. I believe that might have been around the Amazon Go. But I can't say exactly for the theft of what, but that group was pretty well intent on causing destruction yesterday.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And in your latest blog, Jill on Money, you point out that this whole pandemic is making inequality worse. You would think, if anything, it would level the playing field. So why is this happening?
Well, I think what's happening is that we are learning that the pandemic is disproportionately hurting people at the lower end. And that was not what we thought was going to happen. I think that many thought that, you know, anyone in the middle, or, you know, when we even thought about that first CARES Act, that, you know, that if you made $75,000 or less, you got a stimulus check. It was sort of like, well, everyone's going to get hurt. But in fact, what we find is that those people who are not in white collar service professions are the ones that are really getting beat up. And those are people who make $40,000 or less. They're people of color. They're women. They're younger people. They are the disproportionate losers financially and economically from the pandemic. They're the ones who are really bearing the brunt of the damage right now.
So why are these rescue programs like the CARE Act not helping them enough?
Well, I think they are helping them. I don't think that there's any doubt that that extra $600 a week is helping, because it is helping. I think the problem is that when that extra $600 a week runs out and you don't have a job, you're now back to making, let's call it, around $370 a week on average in the United States, and you still don't have a job. And so the reality is that maybe the economy would be much worse without those stabilizers. And I think that that's going to be a real issue as Congress goes back to work this week. They've got to get money flowing into the hands of people who remain out of the labor force through no fault of their own.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out why we're not seeing any inflation, or anybody even worried about inflation, with the trillions that are now being poured into the economy in the form of these basically transfer payments to people who aren't working.
Well, remember that recessions and depressions, not that I'm going to use the D word right now, but recessions are actually deflationary, meaning that there's not as much spending in the economy, right? So spending's bouncing back, but, you know, even retail sales, if you look back to the, you know, same quarter last year as this year, we're still down 8%, even though we had sort of last 2 months, we saw a bounce in retail sales. So I think that what's important to remember is that, you know, when the reason why you hear even conservative economists saying, just get money out there, is because you've got to stabilize the economy first and worry about the debt and the deficit later, because the more important issue is that, you know, we've got to actually get money flowing and get spending up.
But it sounds like we're doing a lot more than just handing money to people who would use it to buy food and appliances and middle class stuff like that. You see, for example, I mean, in the NASDAQ, the tech stocks, Tesla, which as far as I know isn't making any money, it feels like a lot of this money is going into stock speculation, is it?
I can't say that, like, someone who's making $600 a week is going into stock speculation.
No, but the money's going out not just to them, but to other businesses.
True. Right? Yes. But, you know, on any given day, the way that markets move does not necessarily indicate what's going on in the economy. So I think we're conflating two issues, which is, why is the stock market going up amid this period of time where, you know, we've got 32 million people on unemployment and spending is down? And the reason is that the people who actually already have invested money are still working. And the people who actually were able to see through the pandemic and say, hey, you know what, I'm going to invest for 2-3 years down the line. Now, if they choose to buy hot technology stocks that have already gone up, then buyer beware. You know, things can happen. Right now, they're feeling good because the NASDAQ's up. And you know, maybe in 8 months, that ends up being a terrible bet. And maybe in 8 years, it turns out to be a great bet. We don't know. But again, the stock market rise is not indicative that the economy is fine. The U.S. economy is still going to be smaller than it was by the end of this year. We'll not go back to where it was pre-pandemic until the end of next year.
The other thing I read was, far from a baby boom, there has been a COVID baby bust, and that too is bad for the economy, which might be counterintuitive, because a lot of people feel that many of our problems are due to, you know, overpopulation. So why is it that economists don't like to see falling birth rates?
Well, because we want a workforce that's growing, right? And we also want household formation, meaning that we want, you know, if Dave and Jill are dating and everything's hunky-dory, and then we get married and we start what we call our household formation, where we go out, we buy a house, we have kids, we make money, we spend money, all of that is good for the economy. Holding steady or even going down is actually bad for the economy. It's a negative indicator. It is one of the reasons why in Japan they've been in basically a 20-year I would say, sort of stalemate when it comes to the economy that's just not growing, because you need people to come into the labor force to replace the aging workers. And, you know, if you don't have more people coming into the labor force, then when you and I retire, then there will be very few people paying into the Social Security system on which we rely.
Okay, well, that makes it real for me. So so if we're becoming like Japan, is life terrible in Japan? I mean, how would America change if we become like Japan?
Well, I think that it would be a more stagnant economy, and we would really have to be making different decisions about how we want to manage our social safety nets, because you would have an aging population that needs to be supported, and that could mean that you have much higher taxes, much, much higher taxes in the future to basically keep a system where you have so many people tilting into the retirement system. And, you know, we've got a healthcare system that's already burdened. It will be burdened even more, because the older and sicker you are, the worse it's going to get. So, wow, this is so depressing today. So I would say that it is not a good thing for the economy to have low or, you know, stagnant population growth. It's bad for the economy not to have household formation. And what we really need to be looking forward about is, through the end of this pandemic, what policy measures will be put in place to make sure that we don't have these knee-jerk reactions to our, you know, let's say every 10 or 12 year recessions that we have, and they've been bad ones, that we are actually enduring.
Yeah. We could welcome in more young, vigorous immigrants.
I mean, listen, there are some economists who say that if we had a much freer immigration policy, we'd have many more workers coming in, and those workers would help fuel economic growth.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. We had very promising news last week about the Moderna COVID vaccine. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, Moderna says its vaccine has now tested as safe. Some of those safety trials happened in Seattle. They're going on to the next stage now, which is to test its effectiveness. So what does that mean for the timeline? Could we actually see something before the end of the year?
Well, I think what's remarkable is how quickly this happened. I mean, the virus was identified, the genome was published, and 66 days later, Moderna had started a trial, which is really sort of record timing. What they ended up doing was they gave the patients two different vaccines 28 days apart, and they used three different doses, and they were able to identify what the right dose was for the vaccine in terms of generating appropriate antibodies to the vaccine and causing them an acceptable number of side effects. And there were side effects associated with this. Now, the thing is, when they do this, they haven't just tested these patients for a short period of time. They're going to continue to test them in the future. But what they found was the patients developed pretty significant levels of antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 virus in response to their vaccine.
Which shows that it should prevent the virus from taking hold, correct?
Well, that's the question. And it's a great question, because just by developing antibodies to their vaccine doesn't mean that the antibodies are actually protective. Now, here's the thing we talked about before, which is the virus does mutate, and they basically direct the vaccine towards the spike proteins on the virus. But the portion of the virus that's mutating, that's changing, is the spike protein. Now, the vaccine manufacturers are smart, and they recognize the likelihood of mutation. So they try to develop it in such a way that it allows for some degree of mutation. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that it will work. So what they've demonstrated so far is that they've found sort of the right dose of their vaccine out of the three doses, where they can give it and generate a lot of antibodies, and they see the antibody response. But what they don't know yet, and this is going to take time to find out, is, are those antibodies that are generated by the vaccine actually protective against the coronavirus?
And that's the point of the next phase of the trial, is to inject it in a larger sampling of people who they hope are located in an area where the infection is spreading, and see how many get it and how many don't. But that would involve injecting, what, half of them with a placebo. Now, is that considered ethical?
So there's two parts to that. First of all, they plan to inject 30,000 people with the vaccine. And you're right. They will follow those people for an extended period of time and see if the vaccine is actually protective. Now, you asked a question about a placebo. There are actually videos out there now that are, again, critical, largely put out by anti-vaxxers, that are critical of us even producing a vaccine. But the use of placebos and the development of a vaccine is a very ethical question that's actually been addressed by the World Health Organization, because there are some ethical considerations for whether or not you're going to deprive somebody of a treatment. Now, where the World Health Organization has sort of come out on this, if you're comparing two different vaccines, vaccine A that works and vaccine B that's a new vaccine, and is vaccine B better than vaccine A, it's unethical to use a placebo because you have a vaccine that does work. So you wouldn't use vaccine B against a placebo when you have vaccine A that already works. So it would be considered unethical. But in this case, it's considered ethical to use it because there is no other available vaccine. So they actually, despite what the videos from the anti-vaxxers are saying, they actually are using a placebo-controlled arm to this trial to see what happens. So it is done in what is considered by the World Health Organization to be an appropriate ethical trial, and it's also considered to be appropriate scientifically.
So we may get a vaccine in record time. Then the other question is, how effective will it be? Even if it stops the current version of the virus mutates, right?
That's a good question. And the authors of the New England Journal of Medicine paper of the study and the creators of the vaccine are actually worried about this. So one of the things in the trial design was that they tested patients at 7 days post-vaccine, 14 days, and then on days 57, 119, 209, and 394. But what they reported were the results as of day 57. We don't know the results for days 119, 209, and 394. Now, why do they want to keep testing them? Well, they want to know if the immune response is sustainable. Now, it turns out there was a paper that was published from King's College in London that suggests that the antiviral antibodies actually peter out within a few weeks after infection. So that's concerning, because what they found were that antibody levels began to fall about a month after the symptoms appeared, and sometimes to nearly undetectable levels. And so this really raises questions about the durability of a vaccine. And so we also talked previously on your show about people getting second infections. And this is consistent with that possibility, because in those people that we talked about, those people were 2 months or 3 months out from their original infection, and they were getting a second infection. So it is a little concerning. And the authors of the Moderna study are aware of this possibility that there may not be a lasting immune response to the infection. And look, we've never had a coronavirus vaccine before that's been successfully used. And if you remember, the common cold is oftentimes about half the time caused by a coronavirus, and our body's able to elicit an immune response to knock out the common cold. But what happens the following year is we get the cold again. So coronaviruses aren't known for eliciting very strong immune responses. So the question is a vaccine able to elicit a longer lasting antibody response than the virus itself?
And it sounds like, since this is on a fast track, they're going to administer the vaccine before we really know whether it's going to be good, say, a year from now.
Right. Well, the purpose of the original trial was just to determine the right dose and was it safe. And so those 45 patients were able to demonstrate the right dose and whether or not it was safe. And they found that it was. But the next 30,000 patients will actually demonstrate the efficacy. And we'll see. And these same first 45 patients will be followed. And we may see that their antibody levels start falling off as they get rechecked further and further out. And that's going to be concerning if that's the case for the durability of a vaccine.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
And now we're going to meet some coronavirus patients. They call themselves long haulers. They're some of the earliest COVID-19 patients who are still dealing with the physical consequences every day, months after being infected. The report from Cairo Radio's Aaron Granillo.
Christine Ned Blake remembers the day when the first symptoms appeared.
March the 5th, I was working, and at the end of the evening, I had a really bad asthma attack triggered by some hand sanitizer, actually, that was really heavily fragranced. I have asthma, so that kind of thing can happen, but it's actually pretty rare. So that alone was kind of strange.
Christine is 45. She lives in North Bend. And while her asthma does flare up, especially when the air quality gets bad, she says this time was different.
And the next day, I was sitting with my son in the living room, and we were playing a video game. And it was kind of in the evening, and all of a sudden, my whole body was just racked with chills. It was like a wave that came over my whole body. I got really cold, just head to toe, and then really, really hot. And then within minutes, I was physically shaking. And yeah, that was when it started.
And the problems haven't ended since. 135 days later, that puts Christine into a relatively rare category of COVID-19 patients that call themselves long haulers. It's unclear how many of these long haulers are out there, but thousands of people of all ages are flocking to online support groups and sharing similar experiences. Many have never been hospitalized, their cases are classified as mild, but their persistent symptoms are shifting our understanding of the disease and its long-term impacts. And it's becoming clear from their stories that COVID-19 can cause far more symptoms than first suspected. Can you run down your list of symptoms that you've had since March?
Sure. We've got chills, temperature that comes and goes, shortness of breath, chest pain, migraine, like headaches, which I've never actually really had in my life, all sorts of intestinal distress, nausea, all of that good stuff, lightheaded. I've nearly fainted twice when I go from sitting to standing, especially weakness, fatigue. I get the shakes really badly sometimes. Today is one of those days. My hands especially will shake really badly. I've lost my sense of taste. Never for any long periods, but it'll just disappear for a few minutes and then come back. I've had patches in my face go numb for like up to a minute.
One thing almost all these long haulers have in common is their symptoms come in waves. They could feel better for a few weeks before they're knocked back down again.
And a lot of these people are young. They're healthy, they're fit.
That's science reporter Ed Yong. He wrote about long haulers for The Atlantic.
You know, I can't tell you how many people I spoke to were like runners, really like my body is my temple type folks, who have nonetheless been really kicked around by this virus. A lot of these folks have been homebound, bedbound. They've had fevers ongoing for months. They've had rolling waves of neurological symptoms, gastrointestinal symptoms, pain, fatigue. Many of them say very commonly that they try to do mild physical activity, something as simple as going for a walk, doing the laundry, something like that, household chores, and they will get knocked back off their feet for days, if not weeks.
About 14 million people have tested positive for COVID-19, and the World Health Organization says more than half have recovered. But that doesn't tell the whole story. More than 300,000 Americans have signed into an app that tracks COVID symptoms. It's part of a joint project by King's College of London and Massachusetts General Hospital. And while researchers have found that most people do get better within 2 weeks, about 1 in 10 still have symptoms after 30 days. Some can stay ill for months, mainly dealing with breathing difficulties and fatigue. Another issue Christine is battling is that not everybody believes she ever had COVID-19 because she's never tested positive. A lot of long haulers haven't. Science reporter Ed Yong says part of the reason is because so many got sick when testing was scarce and their symptoms weren't linked to the virus at the time.
So things like gastrointestinal symptoms or neurological symptoms that we now know are actually quite common with the illness were not treated as part of it. So folks who had those kinds of symptoms were maybe not likely to think, maybe I have COVID, maybe I need a COVID test.
And as Yong points out, diagnostic tests can give false negatives. They tend to work best when the virus is most prevalent in the body. Doctors think that's within the first few weeks of when symptoms set in. Christine got tested much later.
I've had two negative tests, but that was after testing became available. My first negative test was in April. So I've been diagnosed with it by two different doctors.
And then there is the most glaring evidence that long haulers are indeed struggling from COVID-19. Hundreds of them in online support groups have discussed their symptoms and even ran their own research. Ed Young explains.
A bunch of these long haulers have done a survey of themselves asking what their symptoms were like over time. And if you compare two groups of those people, the ones who have a positive COVID-19 test and the ones who have not, their patterns of symptoms are exactly the same. So two possibilities then, either they both have COVID, which seems pretty likely, or one group has some other completely mysterious virus that happens to be going pandemic at exactly the same time and produces exactly the same symptoms. Either way, there is a big medical issue to solve. More likely, they are suffering from some kind of prolonged immune reaction to the virus that was once in their bodies, that they have, that their immune system in an attempt to fight the infection has gone berserk and is continuing to overreact. But honestly, we don't know.
What we do know is that some COVID cases that end up in the hospital develop what's known as acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. Studies from medical journals, including The Lancet and the American Medical Association, show between 30% and 40% of COVID patients develop ARDS.
A lot of times these patients are physically weak, really lack endurance, and have new changes in their ability to get through their day to take care of themselves.
Dr. Aaron Bunnell is a physician of rehabilitation medicine at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, where he treats the most severe cases of COVID-19.
I would really love to emphasize that if you are healthy and otherwise doing well, it doesn't take you out of the category for severe infection. So I'm seeing a number of patients right now in their 30s and 40s who have had pretty profound effects on their bodies. And one was showing me pictures of just before his hospitalization from the gym. And, you know, he's extremely fit, lifting in the gym, benching, you know, I think he's in mid 200s or something for his bench, doing very well. And now, after standing for a minute, is trembling so bad that he has to sit back down. He had no diabetes, no hypertension, no other conditions diagnosed before this infection.
Dr. Bunnell hopes the lesson people take away from these long-term COVID patients is to reconsider what recovery really means. While millions of people have technically survived COVID-19, their long haul back to full health is far from over.
One example is, you know, if you look at ARDS survivors in the ICU at 5 years, you know, less than half will return to work. So in the U.S., we tend to focus on mortality and not on quality of life and return to work and all the other things that really make life living for us. And I think we also have to understand that in some of those survivors, there's other profound life changes occurring.
Cairo's Aaron Granillo, who co-anchors our COVID-19 podcast, you can subscribe at mynorthwest.com.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Monday's always a good day to hear from CBS's Steve Hartman. He meets a man giving back to the hospital workers on the front lines of the pandemic.
When Steve Derrick of Clifton Park, New York, paints a portrait, there's no such thing as a touch-up. He includes every bruise, bag, and blood vessel.
You're not capturing them at their best moment.
I think I am.
Oh, interesting.
That's when they're strongest, not when everything's rainbows and butterflies behind them.
Indeed. The only thing his subjects have behind them is a 12-hour hospital shift. In the paintings, you see the marks from the masks, the fight in their eyes, and the admiration the artist has for all of them. When this pandemic began, Steve says he wanted to do something as a thank you to those on the front lines. So the amateur artist spent hours in his basement painting tributes to these warriors.
So far, he's done about 100 portraits, many nurses here at Albany Medical Center in Albany, New York. And although Steve refuses payment of any kind, he says he's gotten very rich in another way.
Right here, it's just, that's the payment. That's the reason I do it.
Wealth beyond words.
Yeah.
Steve says he has been overwhelmed by the impact his paintings have had on his subjects, like Albany Med ER nurse Michelle Hanna.
You know, it doesn't make me look glamorous by any stretch of the imagination, but it makes me look like who and what I am and what I was doing.
How you doing?
Michelle recently stopped by to meet Steve and check out an exhibit of his work at the Albany Center Gallery.
These are amazing.
She was deeply moved by the art.
It's the most beautiful thing anybody's ever done for me.
But even more so by the artist and his large-scale generosity. Steve will now be giving away every portrait to the person in it. A forever mirror reflecting that time in their lives when they were at their most beautiful.
Yeah,
I hope the hospital workers are still feeling the love.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes early on, it's all in and then starts to fade away. I mean, they're still.
That's right. You get sympathy fatigue.
But. Yeah.
Joining us from the Gian Ursula show, weekdays 9 to noon, here's G. Scott, who'll be without Ursula because she's on vacation. So who's your co-host?
Dre's.
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 Way too much irony for me. Ike may be kin to you, but he's no uncle to me. How many brothers went to jail on this corner for
moving? That's a clip from Irony on 23rd. I met Dre's. We did a couple of interviews because at one point he was part of those demonstrations against Uncle Ike's pot shop, which coincidentally was set up on a corner once pot became legal, where the black community had been selling it illegally for who knows how many years, and that's the irony.
It's interesting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Dre's will be my co-host all week. I'm looking forward to it, considering I'm born and raised in Chicago. Didn't move here to the state of Washington until 1999. So I am anxious and excited to really get a better understanding of what happened in the Central District and what it was like then, what it's like now, talk about the process of the gentrification, what that has done to the city, what is it going to look like post-pandemic. I'm excited, man, to get to know Dre's. And by the way, it's Dre's and G. Scott on Cairo on Cairo Radio, prime time, 2020, baby. shout out to Cairo Radio. You know what I'm saying? Shout out to Cairo Radio. Yes.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. Hey, I don't know if I know the answer to why you moved here in 99.
I was selling children's toys, electronics, and books door to door. I was a door to door salesman. And when I first moved here, I said, hey, so where's the black neighborhoods at? And they were like, oh, you got to go over to the Central District. You got to go over here. So I went and parked in the parking lot right there off of 23rd and Union, right across from where Uncle Ike's is today. But there's a post office right there on 23rd and Union. And I parked my car there and I got out, had some trinkets and toys and books and walked right into Earl's Cut and Style right there. And so every Saturday morning on the 23rd and Union, that's where I would be set up shop at, selling stuff door to door in that area.
Wow. How'd that go for you?
Hey, pretty good.
I love your story of how you ended up here too.
I got some stories, yeah. But it's definitely the most, how can I say this? You want to learn sales? Go sell stuff door to door. It's the best lesson you'll ever have in your life when it comes to sales.
No doubt.
I could never do that.
Yes, you could, Dave.
I could do anything.
With that voice, Dave.
I'm telling you, yeah. Dave, matter of fact, I was thinking about it, like in the future when we get back to, you know, post pandemic, we're able to have crowds and I'm able to auctioneer again. Can I use you as an intro? Can I just like dub you like, and no, I mean, Dave,
as your studio announcer?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Man, he's got the best voice in the world. Man.
You're the and I would introduce you as the best auctioneer in the world. Or is that still John Curley? I can't remember.
Well,
G's coming for him. So, G, what do you want to say about Congressman John Lewis?
First, I was sad on a few reasons. First, I was sad because we and I say all of us, the United States lost a hero. We lost when people always say, well, who's going to be the next leader and who's going to be the next? I mean, first of all, everybody's a leader in their own right, in their own communities. But John Lewis was everything and more. Here's someone, Colleen, that was arrested 45 times in his life, 45 times in his life. And he's passed on now. And all of the great deeds he's done at the age of 80, he's done between now and then. The boy from Troy, as Dr. Martin Luther King would call him, because it was John Lewis that wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King from Troy, Alabama, and Dr. King read that letter and said, come on. And then when he came there, he said, hey, are you the boy from Troy? And that's what he always called John Lewis, the boy from Troy. And it's just, and the next part that made me sad is I always, it was my goal to meet John Lewis. I said I wanted to meet him, and I didn't get the opportunity. So it's just what a great man he was, everything that he stood for. And this weekend I spent time listening to his speech on the March on Washington back then, and he was the youngest speaker that that was on, that had the opportunity to speak. And Dr. Martin Luther King thought of him so much to have him speak, to see something in him. And you got to think that when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, John Lewis was 28 years old or something like that. I mean, just what an amazing man. And so there's so much to say about him, and the fact that he passes away a day before Nelson Mandela's birthday, and both he and C.T. Vivian passing away on the same day. C.T. Vivian, another civil rights icon and someone who was a trailblazer for our time.
He is part of a generation that that is slowly disappearing. I worked in Atlanta for 4.5 years and remember him from back then, and it's during those years that was my that was the first time I realized the Civil War wasn't over when I moved to Atlanta. I was amazed. The neighborhood divisions were so clear, and also I wasn't used to being categorized as a Yankee. That's the thing that surprised me as a white person, that there was a stereotype of people from New York as well. And that it was during those times, those years, when Atlanta elected its first black mayor ever.
Andrew Young?
No, Maynard Jackson.
Oh, Maynard Jackson.
Maynard Jackson, who made his name joining a garbage strike, I think it was. That was the big movement back then, because, of course, that's who collected the garbage, right, was the black workers. And the campaign from the white mayor, the billboards he put up was against Jackson, was "Atlanta's too young to die." I mean, it's just hard to believe that things were that bad, but they were.
You know, Dave, I had no idea you spent time in Atlanta. And so now, I'm going to have to hit you up off the air and get some of those stories. I would love to pick your brain about what goes on and what happened during those times.
Yeah, interesting times. So it'll be G and Dre's this morning starting at 9.
This is...
This is Seattle's Morning News. With ongoing calls to free all of the protesters arrested over the past several months, King County's prosecutor is setting the record straight about who his office is and is not filing charges against. The report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
One of several demands from Decriminalize Seattle and other groups calling for defunding police and ending systemic racism is to release all protesters arrested in connection with protests over the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, including those arrested during the occupation of the Chaz Chop area on Capitol Hill. Last month, Mayor Durkan already called on the city attorney's office not to charge those arrested for peacefully protesting during any of those demonstrations. Earlier this month, she sent a letter to King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg calling on his office to continue declining to file charges for those picked up in relation to peaceful protests. Satterberg says his office was already on that path from the outset and wants to set the record straight about what happens when somebody is picked up during a protest.
When someone is arrested and they're brought to jail, sometimes the jail will even say so-and-so has been charged, but it's the prosecutor's job to charge. It's not the police who do that. So typically what has happened over the last several months now is that if there is an arrest for it that happens during a protest, the police may book somebody in jail, but they're almost always released the very first moment that they could be, and certainly no later than 24 hours when they see a judge. That's not a charge. That's someone who's been arrested and booked and released.
So even if the jail booking says charged, that doesn't mean the person's been charged. If there is someone Satterberg's office does want to charge, it works like this.
Then we have a 72-hour period for the police detective to rush file a case with us, to bring us a case that we can then get a judge to sign off on within 72 hours. Now, we have filed 15 of those kinds of cases that have something to do with the protests, but we have not charged anybody with a felony for their participation in a protest.
The 15 cases his office have filed are not for people who were just peacefully protesting.
So the cases that we have filed include burglaries from the first couple of nights of unrest when some of the businesses were broken into, or later of Bellevue Square businesses were broken into. We've certainly filed cases involving the shooting, also the vehicular homicide that we filed, and then other cases involving illegal guns and harm. So they're pretty limited.
Satterberg says the general rule for his office,
that protesting and airing your grievances against the government, that's a sacred American right, and you shouldn't go to a protest and then come home with a felony because things got out of hand. There are tensions that mount, and certainly were when the first week or so of June, when the police were pushing back on lines of protesters. We're not going to file any of those cases that are referred to us as an assault 3 against an officer, not without seeing all of the video that's out there. We're no strangers to these protests. We've had May Day riots. I was around for the WTO protests. And so we know that there is video of these incidents, and we're not going to file a serious felony case against somebody without reviewing that video and making sure that it's a strong case. So far we have not filed any of those cases. You know, as an independent arm of the community and the justice system, we're going to take a real hard look at those cases and really only file the ones that are the most serious breaches of public peace.
As far as he's concerned,
I'm satisfied with where we are, and I'm happy to meet the mayor's request to continue to decline to file those charges. That's not where this needs to go. There's an important community conversation that needs to happen, and that's not advanced by us prosecuting people for the incidents that happen during a protest that gets out of hand. And as I say, our Superior Court has historic loads to get through. We have 5,000 cases to resolve right now. So the last thing we need is to bring in more cases at this time.
As for the broader conversation around reforming policing and the criminal justice system, Satterberg's certainly no stranger to those efforts, with his advocacy of the LEAD, or Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, and policies such as not prosecuting people busted with a gram or less of any drug that he put in place back in 2018. And he believes the current conversation about police reform is needed.
It's a moment where we can reimagine the response that we might be able to build. And I think is a good case to be made that we over-rely on police and jail and courts and prosecution for complicated social issues. It's become the default response for drug addiction and mental illness and homelessness and school misconduct. I think there's some good conversations to have, but it's a process. It's not going to happen overnight. We need to build up the other responses. We need to invest in and train more social workers with stabilizing services to respond to some of these human crises. They may also need to have security there when they show up. So it's not going to happen overnight.
The groups pushing to defund police also want a path to life without policing. But that's not a future Satterberg can see happening.
It's not going to eliminate the police. There's too much violence on our streets right now. We're always going to need detectives to solve murder cases and sexual assault cases. And, you know, we can't outsource our response to everything. But at the same time, I do think we've over-relied on police to respond to what are essentially complicated social issues.
Satterberg says to some degree, agencies are going to be forced to rethink how they handle criminal justice, at least in the near term.
It's happening at a time, of course, of COVID when local government budgets are getting hammered. And I've been told to take a $9 million cut from my office in the next biennium. So we're not going to be able to continue to do everything for everybody. We're going to have to really talk about, and the first conversation happens inside my office, is that what are the things that we can continue to do well, and what are the things that we shouldn't do at all? How do we continue to do our work with $9 million less in the next 2 years?
And that provides an opportunity.
We're in a big moment now, a confluence of a lot of major events that have happened, and it's a historic opportunity to use our imagination, design the community that we want and the response that we want to things that are maybe not criminal, but where we have built and over-relied on a criminal response. I would like to see a lot more help for people with drug addiction and mental illness and homelessness, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a police officer who responds. In fact, good arguments could be made that other disciplines would be better to handle those complicated social problems.
And Satterberg says these criminal justice and police reform conversations stretch outside of the local region all the way to Olympia. Among the discussions going on at the statewide level, enhancing the decertification process for officers.
As a lawyer, the Bar Association both gives me my license, but they also can discipline an attorney up to the point of disbarring that attorney for misconduct. The Criminal Justice Training Commission does not do that. The commission issues the ability to be a police officer, but has a very small process for decertification of officers. So there's a lot of different conversations out there. And at the same time, the state budget's going to get hit. I think that there's a desire to continue to reduce the number of people in prison. And our King County jail population, which went from 1,900 to 1,300, that needs to stay at 1,300 or lower, just so that the staff and the people who are incarcerated can be safer. We're just at the beginning of all of this. It's a huge moment, and it requires us to use our imagination and to not make things worse. And frankly, I think filing a bunch of cases against protesters who went to a protest and came home with a felony charge, that would be the wrong thing to do right now.
And this guy with Dan Satterberg, a prosecutor who has been very receptive to reform, at least in my experience. I attended a presentation to the Seattle U about restorative justice, which was pretty impressive and included both victims and perpetrators, and talked about how that works and doesn't always work. But he certainly has been open-minded on that.
It's amazing when you sit down and have a conversation with somebody what you can find out, right?
Absolutely.
It may surprise you.
That's right.